From New York Public Radio, this is On the Media. On the Media is produced by WNYC and heard across America on NPR stations. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Support your local public radio station. Visit onthemedia.org to find where On the Media is playing near you. And please help support this free service by becoming a member of WNYC at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open, how American Express serves small business. Open offers a range of products and services designed exclusively for small business. Details at 888-779-OPEN or open.com.
From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. And this is President Bush.
Anybody who is who's in a position to serve this country ought to understand the consequences of words.
My, oh my. We didn't weigh in when the president changed the rhetorical direction of his war policy by declaring that he'd, quote, never been stay the course. We didn't comment when Vice President Cheney appeared to liken waterboarding to a dunk in the water. Mostly we cover the media, and mostly the media chewed on those howlers for a time and then gulped them down in due course. But the media can't stop masticating on this latest liberal gaffe like a Washington Monument-sized snossage.
It was a botched joke about the president.
Senator John Kerry meant to say that if you didn't study, if you were intellectually lazy, you could get us stuck in Iraq. But he screwed it up and left out the word us. White House Press Secretary Tony Snow just couldn't figure that out.
Where does us fit in? You don't us get stuck? I don't understand. I mean, it doesn't scan here.
Not us get, Tony. Get us. It's not that hard. But leaving out the us, said Snow, said the president, said Limbaugh, made it sound like Kerry was insulting the troops, not the president. And that's not funny. Now, it's true, Kerry is famously humorless. He should never tell a joke. Vice President Cheney, on the other hand, he's a funny guy.
Of course, Senator Kerry said he was just making a joke and he botched it up. I guess we didn't get that nuance. Actually, he was for the joke before he was against it.
But if Cheney was enjoying himself, so were the media. According to TVEyes.com, Kerry's name was mentioned on cable news 715 times in just 36 hours. It's a genuine campaign freak show, a phenomenon explored and deplored in the book called The Way to Win, Taking the White House in 2008 by ABC's Mark Halperin and John Harris, national politics editor of The Washington Post. Harris said that he resisted the story at first.
My first instinct about this was to be somewhat restrained in our coverage. I actually argued it off the front page. I felt that it was kind of a distraction. I don't think the question of what Kerry said is central in the minds of most voters. I thought it was being promoted for partisan purposes. So we put the story on the inside pages with a complete and responsible story, but not a highly played one. The first day. The second day, President Bush was talking about it. Vice President Cheney was talking about it. Everyone was talking about it. I really was in no position to resist that. The story ended up leading the paper.
So Thursday, you ran it as your lead story of the day under the headline, Kerry Offers Apology to Troops. Is there anything substantive going on here? I mean, is this just pure noise?
It's heavily noise, but it's not my job as an editor to delete the noise or pretend that it doesn't exist. Probably George W. Bush's drunk driving incident from 1977 wasn't the most important issue facing the country in the closing days of the 2000 campaign. Nonetheless, that was also something that entered the media echo chamber. I think individual journalists like me are always in a quandary in that we don't run the echo chamber collectively. We only run our part of it.
But you do suggest that this is a bit of a feeding frenzy by the media that often occurs in the final throes of campaigns. Do you think that the story would have been played as big a few weeks ago?
I think that probably would have had a 72-hour trip through the spin cycle. It's just that these 72 hours are probably more critical than the 72 hours of a few weeks ago. The cable news networks were obviously delighted. Here's some content to keep a running story alive. It is being treated like it's the biggest thing facing the country right now. Emphatically, it is not.
But what it is, I think you would agree, is, according to your own definition, a classic campaign freak show.
The freak show is a term that we use to describe extreme rhetoric, flamboyant attacks, a brand of debate which is not really even aimed at illuminating an issue, much less resolving it, but branding your opponent as fundamentally unacceptable and unworthy and beyond consideration.
Isn't the point of every freak show to depict the candidate as a phony?
That's one of the most consistent themes. John Kerry was a victim of the freak show. Al Gore was a victim of the freak show, in that they allowed the opposition, in concert with media allies, to tell the story on the opposition's terms. And in the process of that, they completely lost control of their public story and their public image.
But why is this freak show happening now around John Kerry? He's not even running.
Brooke, the word I think is central is incentives. The people at the White House and in the Republican Party claiming to be offended by this and saddened by this. Of course, they weren't offended and saddened. They were delighted. They thought they had a great opportunity to make the election about John Kerry.
He's an easy target, like shooting fish in a barrel.
And the way to win, the metaphor we use is actually a little bit more raw than that. He's like clubbing a harp seal on the ice. And that is what they did to him in 2004. And that is what they would like to do and have done to him in 2006.
But by covering every back and forth bicker over this misplaced pronoun in Kerry's joke, aren't you playing right into the administration's hands? And don't you think there is a role that discretion can play in how the story is placed and where it's placed?
Yes, I think both those things. We can cover a story, we hope, with skepticism by trying to illuminate what the motives of the various political actors are. I don't want there to be any ambiguity. This is not the world as it should be. Unfortunately, it is the world as it is. The freak show, we try to describe clinically in the book, but we're not neutral about it. We're powerfully opposed to it. It is a corruption of our democracy.
But you're the national political editor of the Washington Post, and I don't mean to keep hammering on you, John, but if you are that opposed to it, if you find the freak show so reprehensible, you could take the Kerry story apologizing to troops and just tuck it inside.
Brooke, I tried that for one day, and indeed, that is what we did. I cannot, by proclamation, create my own reality and say that this was not, in fact, a dominant reality of the closing days of the campaign. And my first responsibility to readers is to describe that reality. Now, I don't think, if you look at the Post stories, that we covered them in a freak show way. I believe we maintained detachment. But nonetheless, you are right. We were responding, in a way, to the freak show. I hope that we were not letting the freak show drive our own values, but unquestionably, the freak show succeeds in driving coverage.
John, it was a pleasure talking to you.
Wonderful to talk with you. Thanks.
John Harris is national politics editor for The Washington Post. He's also the author, with Mark Halperin, of The Way to Win, Taking the White House in 2008.
It was just a brief exchange last week on All Things Considered between host Robert Siegel and White House political advisor Karl Rove. But it was an ear-opener.
We're in the home stretch, and many would consider you on the optimistic end of realism about...
Not that you would be exhibiting a bias or that. You're just making a comment.
I'm looking at all the same polls that you're looking at.
No, you're not.
Every day.
No, you're not.
I'm not.
You're not. I'm looking at 68 polls a week. You may be looking at four or five public polls a week. I'm looking at all of these, Robert, and adding them up, and I add up to a Republican Senate and a Republican House. You may end up with a different math, but you're entitled to your math. I'm entitled to the math.
Wow. The media do their math, but Karl Rove has the math. Kind of makes you wonder if the media polls we're so inundated with reflect electoral reality. On Thursday, we posed that question to Mark Blumenthal, a Democratic pollster and the editor of pollster.com. Mark, with a margin of error plus or minus 3 percentage points, welcome to OTM.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So we just heard Karl Rove assert basically that the media polling data don't amount to a bucket of spit compared to his super double accurate GOP data. Is that just bluster or is it true?
Well, the one thing that he is not bluffing about is the number of surveys he is likely looking at. Party committees on both sides are likely tracking a good 40 or so races on a weekly basis, and there may be another 30 to 50 that they are looking at once or twice a month. The other question is the math he uses to add that up. And one thing I've learned as a pollster is that there are a lot of ways to do math.
Now, see, here I thought that math was immutable.
I'm being a little facetious. 2 + 2 = 4. One way to judge what they're really seeing is to look at the surveys that get released into the general public. Now, it's not a big secret that campaigns and party committees are only going to release surveys when they show good news for their clients or for their candidates. We've tracked the polls in the public domain at pollster.com, and since Labor Day, the Democrats have released 54, the Republicans 13. Just in the last 2 weeks, since October 15, Democrats have released 21 internal polls in races for the U.S. House, Republicans just 2.
So I guess what you've told me is that Karl Rove doesn't necessarily have better polling data, just more of it, and he can see trends in closer to real time.
I think so. I think both Karl Rove and Rahm Emanuel on the Democratic side have more data more regularly done the same way. One of the problems that all the rest of us have at looking at some of these congressional districts is that there may be 5 or 6 polls done in the last month, but they were done by 2 or 3 different pollsters. And it's hard to tell what is real trend and what is what pollsters would call a house effect, where one pollster has a candidate doing a little better or a little worse.
Methodologically speaking, though, there's no significant difference between how media polls are conducted vis-a-vis the tracking polls done by the parties?
It's hard to know because the vast majority of internal polls are not released, so they tend not to be studied by academics. The internal campaign polls typically are making more use of voter lists to do their samples rather than what we call random digit dialing. It would be true to say that political pollsters do more adjusting of the results by demographics or by other attitudes based on their experience or knowledge of a given state. That's something that media pollsters are usually a little less comfortable doing.
Now, putting aside for a moment John Shecky Green Kerry's attempt at joke telling, which has created an uproar at the very late stages of the election, it seemed that the Republicans had so given up hope in a couple of major senatorial races and congressional ones that they essentially pulled out and stopped spending money there. And yet Karl Rove goes on All Things Considered and says, no, what I got right here tells me we are fine. How am I supposed to square that circle?
When you're a leader of the troops, you've got to keep morale up. So I don't begrudge Karl Rove putting the most optimistic spin that he can on the situation that he faces. And he may well believe that they're in a reasonably good position. But if the Republicans really believe that the media polls, either nationally or in states, were so wrong, they certainly have their own internal surveys that they could be releasing to disprove them or raise doubts about them. And while they've done that in a few places, by and large, we're not seeing the Republican internal surveys in the public domain.
Okay, Mark. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mark Blumenthal is a Democratic Party pollster and editor of pollster.com.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Late last week, at the request of Comedy Central, YouTube began purging clips from The Daily Show, The Colbert Report, and South Park. It appeared to be the first step in what was widely seen as the biggest pitfall in Google's purchase of YouTube last month. Many predicted that as soon as YouTube had any cash, content providers would begin to sue. But Columbia Law School professor Tim Wu wrote on Slate.com this week about another possibility, that both Comedy Central and YouTube are playing by a new set of rules that is allowing YouTube to create a whole new kind of copyright. He joins us now. Tim, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much.
So in your Slate piece, you quote from and later rebut the New York Times reference to YouTube as, quote, a litigation-laden landmine, and the prediction that it would go the way of Napster and be crushed under the weight of copyright infringement lawsuits. You say, no way that's going to happen.
I think that YouTube is in a different legal position than companies like Napster, companies that were really straightforward pirate sites. YouTube, first of all, was born of a different lineage. It was born kind of a place for stupid human tricks, and it's always had a lot of legitimate content, if you call legitimate content really bad karaoke, not illegal content. It's also had the advantage of being from the beginning under a much more protective legal scheme. To make a long story short, YouTube has a strong law on its side. It's part of what's called the Digital Millennium Copyright Act that immunizes it from a lot of liability.
I know you say it's a long story, and it is, but I'm going to ask you to make that long story short and give us a little history, basically how the battle over intellectual property became an escalating tug of war between content providers and telephone companies.
Well, imagine yourself back in the early 1990s when people thought that grunge music was here to stay. And imagine there's this thing called the information superhighway. The lobbyists for the film industries and the television industries and music industries had great concerns. They saw what was coming. And they asked Congress to pass laws that would have made the internet as liable as a bookstore for every single thing it carries.
Now, the telephone companies hated that bookstore analogy.
You know, they preferred the telephone analogy. You and I, maybe after the show, could plot to rob a bank over the telephone. And the telephone companies have never been liable for all the numerous bad things that happen over the telephone.
And obviously, this was all taking place when the internet was entirely dial-up and the telephone companies were providing the connectivity.
And after a sort of battle royale between famous Washington lobbyists, they eventually came up with a deal. The phone companies and internet hosting companies are not liable for the materials until they are told that they're actually there, then they have to take them down. And so that allows companies like YouTube, Google, Facebook, MySpace, a million different types of web companies to come into existence under the cover of this safe harbor legislation. And so it was really a big turning point in the internet's history.
You note in your piece, the structure has created a whole new way to use copyrighted material. You used to have fair use, which was legal, illegal use, which is piracy, and something which occurs every day on YouTube, which is called tolerated use, meaning it's not strictly speaking legal, but the content providers like the exposure.
That's right. Use that is illegal if someone complains about it. So it's tolerated. And it sounds like that would be really bad for content owners, but in some ways they like it. And the reason they like it is it allows them to have stuff exposed to the public, and if they really don't like what's going on, then they can have it taken down in an instant.
Yeah, it would seem to be, as you say, absolutely within their control. They want to debut, say, a new TV show. They let lots of clips create buzz on YouTube. Once they've got enough buzz, they take it down. Free advertising.
I mean, that's been the central tension with YouTube and all of internet content, is the first reaction is, wait a second, a million people have stolen our show. And then the next second they say, wait a second, a million people are watching our show. So they have this pathological hatred of piracy, hating losing control over your work. On the other hand, they also love buzz. They want people to see their stuff.
And YouTube will thrive between those poles in a way that Napster couldn't, because Napster was created explicitly to exchange copyrighted material.
Right. Napster was kind of a pimp. You went there because you wanted to get, you know, the goods. YouTube runs the YouTube hotel, and you can check in, you can do good stuff, you can do bad stuff. There is still on YouTube a lot of stupid human tricks that people like to watch. And right now it's kind of a testing ground where things become exposed, bills buzz, and then the industry needs to learn how gradually to start making more money off of that.
So amid all of this tolerated use, and at the same time the industry talking so big about piracy, do content providers risk looking like hypocrites?
If that was their concern, then they've been in trouble for about 100 years. You know, you can call it hypocrisy, you can call it compromise.
Tim, thanks a lot.
It's been fun. Thanks so much.
Tim Wu is a professor at Columbia Law School and author of Who Controls the Internet?
Last month, writers at the monthly magazine Business 2.0 all got new jobs. Mind you, they're still expected to do their old jobs, filing stories for the print edition, but now they'll be blogging as well. No big deal there. As readers move online, publishers will follow. But here's the interesting part. Instead of giving the writers a little more each week in the paycheck for the extra work, the publishers decided to start paying them based on the number of readers who visit their blogs. The more traffic they get, the bigger their cut of the ad revenue raised by the blogs. Clearly, it's a business model that gives writers new incentive for good writing, but does it threaten journalistic integrity in the process? The magazine's editor, Josh Quitner, doesn't think so, and he joins me now to explain why. Josh, welcome to the show.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
For decades, the press has worked very hard to construct these impregnable firewalls between editorial operations and the business side, explicitly to protect the sanctity of the editorial product from any taint of commercial influence. Tell me why this scheme at Business 2.0 doesn't tear down that firewall.
But that's exactly the point. I mean, the beauty of this new medium is my guys don't know who's advertising on their pages. I don't know who's advertising on their pages. I doubt if anyone at CNN Money, which is the overall website that will be hosting us, knows who specifically is advertising on any single blog. It's utterly pure. It's utterly innocent. We all are in the business of serving a reading public. And it makes no sense to put together media that isn't interesting to people.
Well, let me ask you about what people find interesting, because, I mean, to cite a couple of examples, one more extreme than the other, the Sports Illustrated biggest issue of the year is the swimsuit issue, which, of course, has absolutely zero to do with sports and a whole lot to do with staring at nearly naked women. National Enquirer and Star have much bigger circulations than the Atlantic Monthly. Will there not be a temptation for your bloggers to just go for the sort of lowest common denominator and to hit on subjects that are pandering to the reader's baser interest, more down market, even more sensational?
No, absolutely not. Because if my writers start to write about things that are off topic, that are of no interest to a business readership, people won't come back. The web is a very self-correcting place. And don't forget, I still function as an editor here, and part of the deal with my people is I'm reading everything that gets posted.
There are certain things a blogger can do to maximize traffic, things like getting other bloggers to link to your own blog, or using specific words that will likely get a higher blog rating in Google searches and other search engines. If there is a financial incentive just to generate traffic, what's to keep your journalists from rigging the game to get more hits as opposed to finding a more important story?
Well, first of all, I don't think it's easy to, as you put it, rig the game. There's something like 75,000 new blogs being created every day. You know, everyone talks about how this is an attention economy, how you're competing for people's attention. It's not easy to rig that. However, the cover of Business 2.0, the magazine that's about to come out, is real estate. And why am I doing real estate? Well, I've done real estate 2 years in a row now, and it's my best-selling cover. People are really, really interested in real estate. Does that make me a dishonest editor because I'm putting real estate on the cover? Absolutely not. It's a really interesting business story. That's why it sells so well.
I've spent many years in the newspaper business, and whenever I've written a story that, let's say, is confrontational in some way, and the story subject says, you guys just want to sell papers, I've always been able to come back with, what, you think I get a commission? Your bloggers will no longer have that out.
You're supposing that there's only one kind of journalism. You're supposing that there's only newspapers. And if there were only newspapers, I would completely agree with you. If you as a newspaper reporter were monetized based on the number of people who read your story, then you'd be absolutely right. But the newspaper model is based on something that's very, very different from what's going on online. The blogosphere is all about the Talmudic commentary on the text. The text in this case being the highly polished professional pieces that appear in print, on television, on radio. What I'm trying to do here with my folks who put out a monthly magazine is allow them to play in both worlds, is allow them to think entrepreneurially. It allows them to mix it up on a daily, hour-to-hour basis with their sources and live in a world of commentary and instant analysis while at the same time becoming better at what they do and bringing those ideas back to the magazine where they will practice the age-old profession of journalism and go out and report and polish and produce something that becomes the text.
Okay, Josh. Thank you very much. I'm going to give you a qualified good luck on this one.
I'll take that as a qualified thank you.
Josh Quitner is the editor of Business 2.0 magazine.
The world is changing so fast, fueled by computers, its pioneers can barely stay ahead of the curve. But one who has managed to stay out in front is game designer Will Wright. He gave us the ability to design whole new cities in the game SimCity. Then he gave us the opportunity to design whole new lives in The Sims. In a recent New Yorker article, John Seabrook writes that the strange and marvelous Mr. Wright, the god of god games, has been working on yet another game for the past 6 years, one that allows us to design ourselves to guide our own evolution from a single-celled organism in a drop of water to potentially master of the universe, if we survive. Seabrook explains the game called Spore.
It's the game of life in the most possibly complex way you could design it. I mean, it tries to take these Darwinian notions of how life works and model them with software and algorithms and then reproduce all that as a game in which you begin as a single-celled organism and then you evolve through this world of Darwinian. Well, it's not actually interesting because, as Will likes to say, even though it's sort of modeled on a Darwinian system, it's actually more like intelligent design because, of course, it was designed by this one guy.
And you get to function as something of a god, don't you, John? I mean, he allowed you at one point to be some sort of biological editor.
Well, you get evolution points. You get DNA points as you go through the game. And then you get to choose certain improved features for your body based on the environment that you found yourself in. So maybe you realize you're too slow to get away from the predators, so you want some webbed feet. So you get to sort of spend a little bit of DNA on the webbed feet, and eventually you evolve out of the water and you get up onto land.
How do you earn those points?
By surviving into another generation or two. And you do that by killing, essentially, at the beginning. But then later on, of course, you acquire the skill to, you know, conciliate and not just kill. Another aspect of the game, which is extraordinary, is that although it's sort of realistic in a sense that it sort of models real life processes, it doesn't look realistic. It looks kind of like a cartoon. It's very sort of kid-like in a way.
So he hasn't spent a lot of time on fancy, complex graphics. On the
right.
other hand, he has spent a lot of time on the game, and a lot of that is to create, it seems to me, this ever-expanding horizon. I mean, once you've evolved to a point where you have mastery over the world, you get to move out into space and have mastery over the universe.
Yeah, you get to evolve beyond where we are now. I mean, that's sort of like the midpoint. But then beyond where we are now, there's technology that we don't even have yet. And the most powerful of all technologies is a spaceship, because once you have a spaceship, you can do anything. Will refers to it as his Swiss Army knife. It's full of tools. It's a totally cool concept because it's just this thing on your screen, but it will actually give you all these powers. And in order to have it, you'll have to earn it by surviving. And then once you get there, you can explore other worlds. And this is another cool thing about the game, is that the other worlds are actually content created by other players that the game will pollinate your copy of the game with based on how you play.
But it's not a multiplayer game or even a multiplayer world like Second Life, right? This is your own space. So I don't know how that cross-pollination happens.
It happens because the central computers back at Maxis, which is Will Wright's company, are sort of monitoring your style of playing the game and comparing it against other people's style of playing the game, assuming you're networked into the internet, and then it's taking their content and putting it into your content based on what it decides is the best way for your game to be played or what's fun for you to have.
You wrote that conceptually, Spore is radical. What makes it radical?
Well, Will's going more toward a realism of sort of dynamic processes and away from a realism of graphics. And the industry is just the opposite. It's all about realistic graphics. Will's the opposite.
Sort of a philosopher game designer?
Yeah, he's a philosopher. Will has all these very interesting thoughts about how the world works and how our emotions work and how people interact. I mean, Will is an interesting character because, like a lot of sort of software people, he seems slightly sort of to have to reverse program whatever social situation he finds himself in. He's not, like, intuitive, right? He has to sort of, like, study you, and you get the sense that...
You're describing a kind of highly functioning Asperger syndrome.
Well, that one, I think Oliver Sacks said in The New Yorker that he thought that 80% of all Microsoft employees were technically suffering from some form of Asperger syndrome. I mean, he's sort of trying to figure out how life works and then reproducing it in this model in his games.
I guess that's always the question I want to ask. There's that saying, you know, what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. You know, what happens in these games stays in these games. Or is there any application to real life?
That's actually an interesting thought, because that was one of the things I struggled with when I was writing this piece. What happens in games stays in games. It's very difficult to translate the emotions and the whole sort of scenario you become absorbed in when you're playing a game outside of the game. The terms just change. There's this concept called flow. It's like the ideal moment when you and the game kind of flow into this state in which you're sort of one and you're making moves and the game is responding and it's almost anticipating what you're going to do. It is kind of the ultimate man-computer moment where you just become one.
John, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you. It was fun.
John Seabrook's profile of Will Wright, called Game Master, appears in the November 6th issue of The New Yorker.
Up next, if a real journalist interviews a fake person, is he still a real journalist? And blogging the Bible.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Kresge Foundation, investing in nonprofits to help them catalyze growth, connect to stakeholders, and challenge greater support. On the web at kresge.org. The Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities. On the web at wallacefoundation.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. David Plotz, deputy editor of Slate, is Jewish and considers himself a relatively religious person, and yet he has never read the Bible. A self-described Bible ignoramus, Plotz set out to create a blog that would track his first read of the Bible chapter by chapter. David, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you, Brooke.
Who are you to read the Bible and offer up insights?
Well, I think that we're all supposed to do it. Have you read the Bible?
No.
There you go.
Parts of it. Only parts of it.
Well, that was my feeling. That was the situation I found myself in. I had read parts of it. You know, I knew 10 commandments, 12 apostles, 12 tribes, 40 days and 40 nights. There was rain. There was a burning bush. That was about all I knew. And I thought, if this is the thing on which my religion is based, and which 4,000 years of law and scholarship and learning and education are founded, I think it would behoove me to find out what's actually in it and to do it kind of unmediated by the rabbis or the priests and just to see what parts they've left out or what parts are too tricky or what parts don't seem to mean what I was told they meant back when I went to Hebrew school 25 years ago.
And you start your blog entry on Genesis, when God is creating the earth.
That is the beginning. That's the beginning. I knew that much.
And you suggest that God is a tinkerer. And just to give the listeners a flavor, would you read a graph?
Sure. Creation seems so out of order. If God made light on the first day, what was giving the light? Since the sun doesn't appear until the fourth day. And God tackles the major geological and astronomical features during the first 2 days. Light, sky, water, earth. But day three is a curious interruption, plant creation, that is followed by a return to massive universe-shaping projects on day four with the sun, moon, and stars. The plant venture is a tangent, like putting a refrigerator into a house before you've put the roof on.
So what's your goal here?
First of all, just to see what happens to me, sort of theologically and intellectually as I do it, but also to offer a kind of an everyman's reaction. To me, what's been surprising about the whole experience is that the parts that, in fact, that you aren't taught or they discourage you from reading, you know, all the weird incest moments or the kind of genocide committed by the Israelites against various people they came across are so much worse than you could imagine. But at the same time, the good parts, these laws of Moses that are, you know, are kind of too complicated to get into in Sunday school, laws about how you treat the poor, how you treat the blind and the deaf, laws about what justice is, what a judge must do. They're just beautiful and profound.
One thing that you observed from the start is that God seems inclined to prefer clever behavior to good behavior.
That's right. And again throughout the Bible, you see that the man who takes action or the woman who takes action, occasionally it's a woman, even if it's vicious, even if it's immoral, unethical, but it leads to kind of progress, that God appreciates that God shows favor on those who are the smartest. And we see that Jacob is the paramount example, but Joseph, that's true of, and Moses, it's true of, and Abraham. I mean, all these, the kind of older biblical figures aren't really the most admirable men in the world. And because the Old Testament shows so many stories in which there's so much immorality and in which the Jews themselves behave so badly, it's required to try to find moral rules in this kind of stew of immorality and viciousness. And the result, I think, is a religion which works really hard intellectually. And a lot of Jews have actually objected to my reading the Bible as I read it, because they say Jews are not supposed to read it this way, because they're supposed to read it with a teacher, because it's so intellectually demanding and because it's so liable to confuse you.
You had some people objecting to the fact that you were reading this book without a teacher. You were, however, blogging it. Was there something particularly attractive about using the blog format?
I think blogging, it parallels the way people really read the Bible. And in churches or in synagogues, you have a reading for that week. And so I was trying to mimic that. And the blog format turns out to be just a perfect match for it. You know, I can write 800 to 1500 words, and that really can capture sort of what a good day's reading of the Bible is. And it gives readers a way to connect with me immediately, so that I, you know, I just checked before I came in here, I have 3,288 unread messages about this column. You know, I pose a lot of questions for which I need answers from my readers. And so, like, you know, I get hundreds of answers. I get incredibly interesting commentaries. I get, you know, corrections. I get denunciations. I have various people who write me two or three times a day. It's an incredibly useful and vital way to stay in touch with readers.
I have to say, I laughed out loud when you talked about the massive circumcision that went on before they entered the Promised Land.
Yeah, the Hill of the Foreskins. Yeah, there are a million Israelites who crossed over to the Promised Land, and for some reason, I posit it's the lack of bagels and lox. They did not perform circumcisions while they were in the wilderness wandering for 40 years. And so they all get circumcised in this gigantic ceremony, and they leave, I guess they leave the evidence in this one spot, which I plan never to visit when I'm in Israel.
You imagine taking your kids there. No, honey, don't pick that up.
Right. Don't put that in your mouth.
Now, have you found that your reading of the Bible this way has influenced or changed your understanding of your religion?
I'm somebody who kind of believes in God, but in a very vague way. And what's happened is that I've sort of found myself in this kind of conversation with God all the time, where not just when I'm reading it, when you read it, you sort of say, why are you doing this, God? Or good move, God. But I start to think about, well, why would God do something like that? And I don't think it's made me a greater believer in the existence of God than I was before. But I think I'm having a kind of a conversation about the sort of moral and theological issues raised in the Bible in a way that I just haven't for however long I've been alive, 36 years.
David, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
David Plotz is the deputy editor of Slate and author of the book, The Genius Factory.
And now for a few corrections. The first is from veteran CBS newsman Morley Safer about our discussion of Pham Swan Ahn, the great Time magazine reporter who later revealed himself to be a spy for North Vietnam. Safer writes, "You identified the person who started a college fund for Ahn's son as David McCullough, a historian. The man who started it was Frank McCulloch, former Saigon bureau chief for Time. You also stated it as if this was a fund that was just being started. In fact, it ended a good decade or more ago when the young man graduated from UNC. Ahn's first public revelation that he worked for North Vietnamese intelligence appeared in my book, Flashbacks on Returning to Vietnam, published in 1990.
Daryl Plant had a correction about our discussion of ad campaigns launched by two candidates in New Jersey. He writes, "When you were talking with Bob Hennelly about the Menendez race in New Jersey last week, he said that Menendez, quote, had the distinction of being one of the few House members to vote against the resolution used by President Bush as a justification for war. In actuality, 126 Democratic members of the House voted against H.R. 114 to, quote, authorize the use of United States armed forces against Iraq, along with 6 Republicans and 1 independent. That was a solid majority of the Democrats in the House. 81 voted for the resolution and 1 abstained."
And yet another correction, this one concerning our commentary on the 50th anniversary of the TV remote control. It comes from Mark Shubin of New York City, who writes, "I hate to do any nitpicking, but I believe it's important to preserve the accuracy of my favorite news program. 2006 isn't the 50th anniversary of the television remote control, the wireless television remote control, or even Zenith's wireless television remote control. It is the 50th anniversary of Zenith's Space Command wireless remote control, invented, as you correctly noted, by Dr. Robert Adler. A year earlier, in 1955, Zenith introduced the Flashmatic wireless television remote control, invented by Eugene Poley. That was the first wireless television remote control. Zenith came up with the first wired remote control, the Lazy Bones, in 1950.
Thanks to all those listeners willing to speak truth to power, or at least to me and Bob. Keep those corrections coming to onthemedia@wnyc.org, and don't forget to tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name.
is, you come see my film. If it not success, I will be executed.
That, of course, was Borat. Title character of Borat, Cultural Learnings of America for Make Benefit Glorious Nation of Kazakhstan. The comedy brainchild of Sacha Baron Cohen opening this weekend worldwide. Gotta tell you, for the past 4 months, I personally have waited for this movie the way my 5-year-old waits for Santa, which is to say, pretty much out of my mind with anticipation. Because going back to his days as a character on Baron Cohen's Da Ali G Show, I love him. Evidently, I'm not the only one.
Borat, it is such a pleasure to have you.
Thank you very much.
Yes, yes, yes.
Very nice.
Chikui.
Chikui. Thank you for come.
Yes.
We go now.
That was Harry Smith with Baron Cohen on Friday's CBS Early Show. And here's Matt Lauer with Baron Cohen earlier last week on The Today Show.
What did you learn about Americans by touring the streets of New York?
I learned many things. For example, I learned that it is now illegal to shoot at Red Indians.
Actually, I should clarify. Strictly speaking, CBS News and NBC News didn't host Sacha Baron Cohen. They hosted Borat, the clueless Kazakh TV correspondent who wears a smelly gray suit and, you know, what do you call it? Oh, yeah, doesn't exist. This didn't seem to bother CNN International, whose anchor Becky Anderson not only conducted an interview with a fictional character, but threw herself into the conceit.
Let me just ask you, I wondered whether there was any opportunity for me. I've got plow experience, I've got no retardation in the family, and I'm not Jewish. Any chance that you and I could have a little thing?
Well, I don't want to go in the wrong track, because last time I buy a wife.
To just interview him and ask funny questions, especially, would you take me as your wife? There's not a lot of journalistic purpose in that.
Kelly McBride is a journalism ethicist with the Poynter Institute. She has this crazy idea that people in the news media shouldn't damage what little remaining credibility they still have by participating in comedy skits with fictional characters.
I don't think to simply entertain the audience, I don't think that's a good enough reason to let someone pull off a fiction on a news program. I think the viewer will scratch his head and wonder where he should turn for serious journalism, for information that actually is going to improve his life and his understanding of the world.
On the other hand, the viewer does get a pretty good idea of how hilarious the Borat movie is likely to be, which may not serve any journalistic purpose, but is a publicity windfall for 20th Century Fox. Freelance movie reporter Louis Beal, who writes for the New York Times and others, requested an interview with Baron Cohen, but was told by Fox publicists that only Borat himself was available. Beal declined.
I couldn't imagine why anyone would want to interview him in character. I mean, first of all, he's playing a character. Second of all, the character's an idiot. What would you hope to gain from that interview? It's not about journalism. It's basically about shilling for the film company, and I find that disgraceful.
Of course, you can argue that most celebrity journalism is guilty of that already. One puff piece after another, stage managed by the studios, timed for the release of a new movie. Often, reporters are herded in for group interviews or 5-minute drive-bys, allowing them to assemble a piece that looks like some journalism has taken place. Beal doesn't participate in those junkets on anti-prostitution grounds, but he thinks even that pales on the whoreometer next to clowning with a character in character.
Because basically, at least with those other interviews, even though they're trying to sell their movie, if you sit down and talk to them as human beings, you can occasionally get real responses from them that deal with real issues or real things to do with the movie. By all accounts, Sacha Baron Cohen is a Cambridge graduate, an observant Jew, speaks fluent Hebrew. I want to interview Sacha Baron Cohen and ask him, what are you accomplishing by bringing this racist, homophobic, anti-Semitic Kazakh character to the United States and having him riff on all sorts of people all over the country? What do you think you're getting at here? When you're dealing with a character like Borat, you're just getting shtick. Shtick is not journalism.
It's also not unprecedented. Dame Edna, the invention of performer Barry Humphries, was interviewed in character by many journalists, including NPR's Scott Simon. To promote the 1986 remake of Little Shop of Horrors,
Some media outlets interviewed the leading character, Audrey II, who was a carnivorous plant. And 25 years ago, conceptual comedian Andy Kaufman shunned press availabilities as himself, but would sometimes answer questions as his alter ego, a sleazy lounge singer named Tony Clifton.
You had a rather rough crowd tonight.
There were. There's a few people walked out, as you might have seen.
How do you maintain up there, your act, when you see people walking out on you?
They're lost, not mine.
Maybe in a world of suspended habeas corpus and missing WMDs, the question of journalism as movie promotion seems like small potatoes. But ethicist Kelly McBride points out that every interview with Borat squanders an opportunity to cover the actual news surrounding this particular film, namely that Baron Cohen's hilarious methods of exposing racism, anti-Semitism, and petty hypocrisy have infuriated some who either think the ends don't justify the means or just don't get the joke altogether. This would include pretty much the entire country of Kazakhstan.
When you give a platform to the speech without any other context, you're essentially being complicit in promoting something that a fair number of people find horribly offensive. And I think as a journalist, you've got to ask yourself why you would do the interview in the first place.
The footnote to this story is the plight of Dharma Arthur. She was a producer of the WAPT Noon News broadcast in Jackson, Mississippi, featured in the film. In that sequence, Borat has been invited on the program to discuss his work as a visiting Kazakh TV correspondent and quickly horrifies everyone with his Borat-titude. As it turns out, Arthur had invited him thinking he was the real deal. After management realized she'd booked a fictional character by accident, she was fired. For being duped, in other words. If she'd been a co-conspirator in the fraud, maybe she'd be working for the Today Show. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, Mike Volo, and Mark Phillips, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director, and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. We had help from Alicia Rebensdorf and Michael McLaughlin. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer, and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org, and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Thanks for checking out this week's On the Media from WNYC, New York Public Radio. Support your local public radio station. Visit onthemedia.org to find where On the Media is playing near you. And please help support this free service by becoming a member of WNYC at WNYC.org. And thanks.